Right, as we prepare to begin the kinnis, or the first kinnah begins with a kinnah which, like many of the kinnis, has the order of the aleph beis. However, for reasons that need to be explained separately, it begins with the letter samach. Suru meni, shemuni ayvra. As you see, it goes samach ayim pei to the end of the aleph beis. It doesn't have the first part of the aleph beis, which is a discussion unto itself. However, the kinnis begin with the word shavas. Before suru, the word shavas, which appears, is added as an introduction to kinnis in general. And the theme of shavas is very much the theme of what Tisha B'Av is about. And it's easy to misunderstand the idea, the concept of what we mourn on Tisha B'Av. It's easy to think of it as the destruction of a Beis HaMikdash, the death of many, and the different sorrows that took place over the generations. In fact, on Tisha B'Av, we talk about the fact that things changed, that the world order changed, that the way the world exists took a change, not a change for the better, with each step of tragedy that took place on Tisha B'Av. In the Chumash, when we first learn about the Mishkan is going to be built, it's in Parshas Truma. So as you know, we go through Sefer Bereishis and then Shemais till we get to Truma. And then when we start talking about the Mishkan, the rest of the Torah Shebiksav is virtually, totally, and certainly mostly involved in the Mishkan. You have, of course, Truma, Tetzaveh, and Vayakal and Pekudeh at the end of Shemais. Vayikra is the Sefer of the Karbanis. And Bamidbar as well, the Parshas Bamidbar talks about the setting up of the Machnos around the Mishkan, and Nosa is about the Chanukas HaMishkan, and Baal Oischa, about the Neiris, and the Levium, and the Karban Pesach. So that essentially, as soon as the Mishkan starts to appear in Torah Shebiksav, it suddenly is most of Torah Shebiksav. Seder Kodshim in Torah Shebiksav is more than probably the other five, certainly more than the other five Siddurim put together. So that even though a Torah Shebaal-Peh, Kachim is a piece of the Torah, in Torah Shebiksav, the idea of the Mishkan, later the Beis HaMikdash, is very central to the existence of Klal Yisrael. And the reason for that is that a human being lives most of his time busy with day-to-day things. What did a Yid do? A Yid worked with his behemoths. Either he was a farmer, or he raised sheep for wool, or he raised cows for milk, and spent most of his day in his field with his animals. Perhaps he was he had a mill and he milled his wheat. Whatever it was, he spent most of his day in day-to-day things in the part of life that doesn't go anywhere. It's pretty much, you exist, you do something, you do it again the next day, you make money, you spend money, you eat, you sleep, you go to sleep, you wake up. It's basically an existence, which is an Olam Hazeh existence that doesn't go anyplace. And for that, we had a Beis HaMikdash. And the Beis HaMikdash was a place to go where you saw the majesty of Kvod Shemayim, a place where Nisim were routine, a place where you could sense, you could feel Kvod Shemayim. There was a sense of Shchina in the Beis HaMikdash. There was a sense of awe. And Yidden went to the Beis HaMikdash regularly. They were Ayla, Shalish, Regalim. But they went up on other occasions as well. Yolada, somebody had a child. They went up to the Beis HaMikdash. Certain types of Tuma, a person went up to the Beis HaMikdash. A Karban Taida, somebody had to offer thanks to Rabbi Yishalam. He went up to the Beis HaMikdash. So that the existence of the Beis HaMikdash was a reality check. It was really a place to go and realize that there's more than hitching up your animals to the plow and plowing the field and cleaning up after them and harvesting and just doing that every year again. What do? You just basically, the existence that we have is an existence of sustaining ourselves in Olam Hazeh, a very pointless existence in and of itself. So the Beis HaMikdash was that place, the reality check place, where people could come and check in, so to speak, with the Shechina, with spirituality, with Ruchnius, with a totally different level of existing in this world. Shavas is an idea that the Churban Beis HaMikdash was a change. It was all of the tragedies of Tisha B'Av are changes in the way the world is, changes in the way our lives are, fundamental changes, changes in day-to-day life, in the way we live. And we're not mourning the people that died or the building that was destroyed or the fact that we went to Galus, as much as we're mourning the fact that there was a fundamental change in the lives that we live, in the existence that we have. One of the five things that we talk about on Tisha B'Av is Nechrasha Ha'ir, that the city was plowed over, which took place well after the Churban, a couple of generations later. What is the big tragedy of Nechrasha Ha'ir? I could think of many other tragedies that are worse. Nechrasha Ha'ir didn't involve pogroms, didn't involve the death of anyone. The city of Yerushalayim, which was a destroyed city, was plowed over. The explanation of the concept of Nechrasha Ha'ir is also that there was a fundamental change. As long as there was a city of Yerushalayim and there were destroyed buildings, there were remnants of buildings, there were broken down buildings, it was a place. It was a place that existed. It was a place. It was a destroyed place. It was a desolate place. It was a place of tragedy. It was a place. The existence of Klal Yisrael was Avram Korei Har and Yitzchak Korei Sada and Yaakov Korei Bayis. The Gemara says that Klal Yisrael perceived the Mokem HaMikdash slowly as Bayis, as a place where we live, a place where Klal Yisrael lives. Yaakov Avinu put down 12 stones, not much of a Bayis, but it was a foundation of what was to come. Nechrasha Ha'ir means that there was nothing. That where Yerushalayim once existed, it was a plowed over place, it was back to Sada, back to Har, it was back to Tzia and Sada Techaresh, the idea of Kilu it didn't exist, Kilu it's not there. It's a fundamental change in the psychology of people. And when we sit and say Kinnis on Tisha B'Av, we're mourning the changes that took place to our lives, that affected our lives, that our lives are so different because of the Churban. Our connection between Ruchnius and Gashmius is so barely there. It's very hard. It's a struggle. We don't have the Beis HaMikdash. We don't have what we once had. And that idea, that concept, lies all in the word Shavas, which is the first word of Kinnis. Shavas, it stopped. It came to a standstill. It didn't continue. And then we go on and we get into the particulars of the kiddush. Today I'd like to talk about an aspect of Tisha B'Av that's not often talked about, and that's World War I, which also began on Tisha B'Av. It's now going to be 100 years. It was Tisha B'Av in 1914 that World War I began. And because the Holocaust so overshadowed it in its scope of death and barbarism, the death of a quarter of a million Jews in World War I pales when you compare it to the death of 6 million. Nevertheless, if we talk about Shavas, I'd like to talk a little today about World War I, about the beginnings of a change in the world that took place over the last century. We live our lives, most of us were born after the Holocaust. We grew up, most of us have grown up here in the United States, in a sane, relatively sane and rational world, at least until fairly recently, a world in which there's an order of things. There are police, you call the police, something happens. There's justice, there's a court system. And fortunately, we're in a position where we don't appreciate the existence of Klal Yisrael and Galus, what it has been like. The anti-Semitism of the world today is more of the usual than the unusual as far as Klal Yisrael's experiences in Galus. It's more of the Esav Seine Es Yaakov, which is part of the Holach Yelach of Klal Yisrael throughout our existence. I'd like, if I may this morning, talk about the change that took place from the world of 1913 to the world of 2013, perhaps to try to appreciate it. Now, Futner wrote a Haskama to Rav Rattenberg's History Svarim. And in the introduction, he talks about whether learning history is part of Torah. Learning the history of Klal Yisrael, whether that's considered part of Torah. And his the idea that he writes of the idea that Yisrael, Hashem, and Torah, Chadohem, just like learning about the Midas of Hashem, while we know about Hashem is Torah, he says, right, learning about the history of Klal Yisrael is Torah itself, and certainly what Tisha B'Av is getting out of our cocoon and looking at the history of Klal Yisrael, what brought us till here. And for that reason, I'd like to spend some time just discussing what changed from 100 years ago until today. What has changed in the world, a fundamental shavas that took place, and what has changed as far as Klal Yisrael. In a nutshell, what changed is that Europe was the center of the world. Europe in 1913 was a place of empires. And that's the way it was from Nebuchadnezzar until World War I. It was a world in which there were global empires. There were great countries that controlled much of the world. And by and large, the existence of individual areas, areas where Jews lived, areas in general, was not so micromanaged, so to speak, as it is today. There was less central control, and there was a great difference in countries where people lived. In 1913, the great empires of the world were the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, which controlled a lot of southern Europe and controlled the Middle East, all of the Middle East, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and of course Eretz Yisrael, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which controlled, together loosely confederated with Germany, controlled Central Europe, the Russians that controlled Eastern Europe, and then in Western Europe you had basically the French and the English, who controlled a lot of Africa, a lot of the possessions all over the world, India and Pakistan. These were all controlled by countries in Western Europe. And these were empires that controlled. What happened from then to today is that there aren't empires. The centrality of Europe to the world existence today is pitiful. The attempt to create a European Union is an attempt to awaken the importance of Europe in the world. Europe today is a piece of the world. It's not the controlling part of the world anymore. And countries like France and England, which have the veto power in the United Nations, have so based on their history, not on based on the countries that they are today, which are not the powerful countries and empires that they once were. Now that changed in the time period that began with the Holocaust. What happened to Klal Yisrael in that time was exactly the same thing. Klal Yisrael, certainly Ashkenazic Jews and Sephardic Jews on a different time schedule, but Sephardic Jews too, who are in Spain and in the Arab countries, were basically all Yiddishkeit was grouped around the European countries, and that has changed. That has changed. The whole binyan of Yiddishkeit that was Klal Yisrael, that was Klal Yisrael Kemat from the Golus till today, from the Golus until World War I, that stopped, that ended. Shavas, it doesn't exist. It's no longer there. Today we have people who, in their later years, mourn what they had seen. There are trips back to Europe today. These trips back to Europe, if you remember, are basically for the last 15, 20 years, that people organize trips to go back to the European countries. And I don't imagine they'll last more than another decade. And that'll become history, like the Spanish Inquisition was history. That will become the history, what was. So that the beginning of World War I was the beginning of the end of European influence in general and the centrality of Europe to Yiddishkeit. Now, what I'd like to do is tell you two stories. I'd like to tell you the story of World War I on the world history stage, how it took place in the very abridged version. And then story number two is the story of the Yidden as took place during World War I, and hopefully to have a little bit of an appreciation that the events that take place in the world, are events that have hidden in them HaKadosh Baruch Hu's yad of influence on Klal Yisrael. If you study about the beginning of World War I, if somebody wrote a novel with the story, it would be so absurd that nobody would read it. Nobody would buy it. World War I began in the summer of 1914. It began at a time, World War I was basically three countries against three countries, Russia, France, and England, who were allied yet before World War I, who had pacts between them, against the Germans, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which, as I said, very much tied to Germany, and the Turks, the Ottoman Empire. All the countries in the world were heavily armed. That was the result of the 19th century, which is a century of many wars, many small wars, many short wars, a couple of long wars. All the countries were heavily armed and basically didn't like each other. Basically, the countries had beat up one or the other in the previous century, and there was a lot of hatred, of enmity. There were a lot of pieces of land that countries had taken away. There was, 100 years ago, there was no Poland. Poland was not a country. There was no Czechoslovakia. There was no Yugoslavia. All these countries did not exist. Poland was half Austrian and half Russian, what we call Poland today. And what happened, ridiculously enough, was that the tinderbox of arms that was Europe ignited over a seemingly minor incident. The Franz Josef, the leader of the emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, had a son. Somebody by the name of Ferdinand, who was a playboy, who traveled and enjoyed a good life. And he was in Serbia. And in Serbia, a 19-year-old boy threw a bomb into his car, killing him and his wife. And it was not something done by the Serbian government. It was an anarchist who was caught that threw this bomb into the car. What happened then was that Austria threatened Serbia. Serbia was a small country, and it was seen by Russia as a satellite of Russia. Russia saw itself as the protector of Serbia. And Austria basically gave an ultimatum to Serbia, which Serbia could not accept. An ultimatum, and Austria mobilized for war, threatened war to Serbia for what had taken place. When the Russians saw that the Austrians were going to war, they mobilized for war. And the Russians, as only the Russians can do, did things the way Russians do it. They called up 4 million men, mobilized 4 million men to go to war. But they still didn't go to war. And then, when the Russians mobilized, the Germans, who saw themselves as the allies of Austria, the Germans mobilized and sent Russia a message that if they didn't demobilize, that the Germans would mobilize. And you have to know, Germany was headed then by the Kaiser, Wilhelm, who was a comical figure. If you wrote a book about him, he's one of two very strange creatures that existed. Kaiser Wilhelm is the one you see in those pictures. He was a man of grandiose dreams, costumes. He had, you saw pictures in World War I of the Russian hats with the pointy tips up on the top. Very strange uniforms that they wore. Remember once we were talking about why they had these pointy tips. And after someone sat down on a hat in yeshiva, we said, wow, now we understand why the Germans had these metal tips on their hats. It sort of ensured that no one would squash their hats. Very, very strange. If you were in Eretz Yisrael, I'm sure you all were, and you went into the old city through Rehov Yafo, you see that all the gates, through Shar Yafo, if all the gates of Yerushalayim, all our gates, there's a wall around the city, and when there's a gate, there are bricks over the gate through which you enter the any Shar. You go through Shar Shechem, you go through Shar Ashba, right? It's a gate with bricks over it. When you go through Shar Yafo, which is the gate through which you go when you go by vehicle, you'll notice that there are no bricks up above. The wall sort of comes to an end on the left, comes to an end on the right, and there's nothing above it. Let me tell you why that was so. Because Wilhelm, the Kaiser of Germany, visited Palestine in the early 1900s, and he was a tall man who sat on a tall horse with a very tall hat that had a tall point. And before he came, they measured the opening of Shar Yafo, and the tall horse with the tall Kaiser with the tall hat didn't fit. The Kaiser would have to bend his head down to make it through the gate. The Kaiser doesn't bend his head down. And for him to enter Yerushalayim once, he had them remove the bricks, the whole brickwork from the top of the wall around Yerushalayim. He had them remove it so that when he went in, he could go in with his head held high. So like I say, you get a picture of who he is. If you wrote a book about such a character, it would be hard to believe. He was a man of tremendous dreams. And he, more than anyone, Hitler is known as the Russia of the destruction of European Jewry, and it's true. But the fool, the one who really got it all started, was this Kaiser Wilhelm. What he did was to get his soldiers together, and again, Austria mobilized against Serbia, and Russia mobilized against Austria, and Germany mobilized against Russia. And Russia had a pact with France and England. So France and England mobilized. And the whole country was sort of sitting, waiting for a war, which nobody really wanted, but which began, as I said, on Tisha B'Av of 1914. It began with the Austrian attack, and everybody had time to make plans. And the war that followed was one of the most unusual, certainly the most unusual war in the history of the world, more so than World War II. Basically, there were two wars that took place. Germany, with Austria in the center, fought one war to the east against Russia, and one war to the west against Germany, against France and England. So let me tell you what happened in a nutshell. The Germans border France. France had fought Germany in the 1870s. France had spent two generations building up fortifications on the border between France and Germany. What the Germans decided to do is not to attack France at their border, but to go up through Belgium. Belgium is a country north of Germany and and France. German neutrality was guaranteed by the great powers. And when they tell you that anybody's going to guarantee anything these days, a guarantee is only worth it until somebody wants to break the guarantee. The Germans decided that they would go up through Belgium and attack France from the north and march into Paris. The French soldiers were all on the German border, and they had this plan, a plan which really they had for almost a decade of attacking France. And this was the plan, to go and attack through Belgium. And they nearly succeeded. They didn't count on the Belgians putting up resistance. They counted on getting to France within 2 or 3 days. The Belgians put up resistance, held them off for almost a week. The Belgians let all the dikes. Belgium is a low country and has dikes that hold back the water. They let the dikes open and flooded the lower part of Belgium, and thousands of German soldiers drowned. And until they got into France, took them the extra week that the French were able to resist. The Germans got within 30 miles of Paris. The 30 miles, you know, is not very far. And there, the French and the English fought the Germans to a standstill. And that took about 6 weeks. They fought to a standstill. And there, on the Western Front, they parked, they dug trenches, and they shot each other, killed each other for 4 years. Basically staying in exactly the same place. There was no war like this in the history of the world, where people, and there were countries that had trenches facing each other for 4 years. But to be actively killing on such a regular basis is the most unusual of wars. Makes no sense from anybody's standpoint. And there are stories about Gideon on both sides of the battle. As a matter of fact, part of the strange war protocol of World War I was that they fought by day, and at night everyone had to get a good night's sleep. So at night everyone stopped fighting, and they would come out and carry out the bodies, bury them. The story is that the Yidden would make minyan from the two sides. They get together in no man's land and call out for minyan to get together. Then go back on each side and shoot at each other in the morning. This is World War I on the Western Front, a standstill for 4 years, people shooting each other. Basically, the Germans and the Austrians against the French and the English. The truth is, they would still be there were it not for the fact that the United States came into the war. The United States, which had a strong policy of neutrality in that time period, Woodrow Wilson was the president of the United States. He ran for re-election on the basis of he kept us out of the war. He was elected, and then he promptly got America into the war. Something that Lyndon Johnson was to do again 50 years later. Basically, the reason America came into the war is because of the arrogance of the Kaiser. We've all read about the submarine warfare, where the Germans didn't want... America was making money on both sides. America was selling arms to Germany and selling arms to France and England. And the French were not happy. The Germans were not happy, and they went about the sinking American freighters that were crossing the Atlantic to France and England. That's what brought the United States into the war. And basically, you had soldiers that were shooting at each other for 4 years and burying their dead and were tired of war. And the United States came in with fresh soldiers, and that tipped the balance on the Western Front. That's one war. That's part of World War I. Of greater importance to the Yidden was what took place in the East between the Russians and the Germans. The Russians generally win wars by throwing people at cannon fire. But basically, a cannon can only shoot so many cannonballs, and if you have enough people, it can't kill all of them. And Russians in wars have lost a tremendous number of people. World War I, which involved the death of somewhere between 10 and 12 million people, and the crippling of another 5 or 6 million involved great losses in the Russian army. The Russian army lost 2 million men. When Russia attacked, Russia saw an opportunity to grab land, and the Russian attack into Austria was a disaster. The great battle of Tannenberg. The Russian army was totally destroyed. The plan was for two Russian armies to come, one from the south, one from the north, and meet and destroy the enemy, and the reverse happened. They didn't meet. They were off, and the Russian army was totally destroyed. 100,000 dead, 100,000 captured. And I'm talking in one day. The Yid who reads this, you know, the general of the Russian army was Samsonov, a fellow who committed suicide at when he saw what was happening. Not a very encouraging thing to his soldiers. He committed suicide because he saw what was happening. Like I say, Yid reads it, you know, he's Samsonov. I don't know if they named him after Shimshon or they didn't name him after Shimshon, but you hear about, just strikes a chord. What it means, I'm not sure. But at any rate, what took place on the Russian front was tremendous losses by the Russians. And that was a terrible tragedy for Klal Yisrael. What happened in Russia, Russian Jews suffered the most in World War I. What happened in Russia was that basically the Germans succeeded in penetrating parts of Russia, capturing big pieces of Russia. You can't capture all of Russia because Russia is big, and Russian winter is not a time that anybody could fight. And the Russians just kept on calling up soldiers and throwing them at the enemy, no matter how many they lost, but they didn't lose their ground. They stood their ground. What happened in Russia at the time, and this is the second, I said there were two comical figures, the Kaiser of Germany, and the leadership of Russia. The leadership of Russia, the Tsar of Russia was Tsar Nicholas, who was a man who apparently was very short in the brains department. He had one son. He had a number of daughters, which didn't count when you were a Tsar. And he had one son. And that one son, son Alexander, was a hemophiliac. He was a son who bled when he had any type of bleeding. The bleeding didn't stop. And the Tsar was very superstitious. And he got a faith healer. Must have been an ad in the paper for send me money, Yeshua's guaranteed. And he got one of these guys who advertised these Yeshua's, no doubt with a picture of an Adam Gugel underneath. One of the strangest figures in the history of, to affect the history of the world, a man by the name of Rasputin, Grigory Rasputin, was a faith healer. If you drew a comic book picture of a guy with a tall hat with stars on it, that's pretty much the way he looked in the pictures. He was some type of faith healer, and he convinced the Tsar that the Tsarevich was the Alexander's name. Why is he called the Tsarevich? So you should know that in Russian, the word vich, the suffix vich at the end of a word, means son of. So Tsarevich was the son of the Tsar. All of the Yiddish, all the Yidden who have names from Avram, Yitzhak, or Yaakov, Abramowitz is Abramovich, Isaacovic, or any other name, Jacobowitz. Every name seems to have a vich ending to it. Mendelovitz or any of these names are basically, when the names were added, the Vitz, the son of, was added to whoever was the head of the family. So it became a Vitz at the end. I always tell the Rabinowitzes that really Rabinowitz is the Babad family. The Rabinowitz means the son of the rabbi. And that's where the Vitz ending comes from. And anyway, this son of the Tsar was treated by this kook, who advised the Tsar. He was a total nut who believed in, he was an immoral person, a member of the Russian church. But Snegeya, us, as Yidden, should read once the story of they went out to assassinate this fellow, this Rasputin. And I once read one of the history books, the story of his assassination. They tried to kill him. They shot him. He fell down. He got up and started running away. They shot him a bunch of more times. He kept on running away. And then they tried to drown him. They had a hard time drowning him. He was, I don't know. You know, he had maybe some koiches hatuma that exist. Until they finally got rid of him. But until they did, he basically destroyed Yiddishkeit in Russia. What he did was to tell the Tsar, and then whatever he said was gold, because he was able to stop the Tsar's son from bleeding. So he told them that the Jews were doing it all. The Jews were spies, and all the Jews in Russia were forced to go, to move into deep Russia. Because they weren't trusted as spies, they were to be kept away from the Germans and the Austrians. And they were all exiled. When you read stories about the yeshivas in Radin and Slobodka during World War I having to run away, they weren't running away from their enemies. They were running away because their own government, the Russian government, forced them. The Chafetz Chaim split the Radin yeshiva into three groups and until they were able to come back after the war. Yidden, for Frumkeit to exist, Yidden need a community. You need a shul, you need a sefer Torah, you need a mikveh, you need shchita, you need all the things that make a Yiddish a community. And what Rasputin basically did was to destroy, even before the communists came, was to destroy Yiddish life and to bring about pogroms, countless pogroms that took place in Russia. And this was for 4 years, from 1914 to 1918. What happened ultimately in Russia, Russia did so poorly in the war that there was a revolution. In 1918, the February Revolution, which was the brief period of democracy that Russia had, and then the October Revolution, which was the revolution of Lenin and Trotsky, which brought communism to power in Russia. And again, Jews were on the suffering end of both sides. When the communists came to power, they sued for peace. In World War I, Russia actually sued for peace to Germany. Germany essentially won the war against Russia, took large pieces of land from Russia. The communists felt that give away whatever they have to give away. They gave away Poland, they gave away large pieces of land in order to sue for peace, and they felt that anyway, communism was going to take over the world later, so it didn't matter. So in a nutshell, these were the two fronts of the war that took place. The outcome of the war was a tragedy for Klal Yisrael in two places. One was in Russia during the war, the death of many, many Yidden, of the 250,000 Yidden who died in the war, probably 200,000 died on the Russian side. And the tragedy on the Western Front was what took place afterwards. The war ended when American troops came and broke the German ranks. The Kaiser abdicated. He decided that he had enough of being Kaiser. He just wanted to go to some beach somewhere and retire. And the provincial government of Germany surrendered. And unfortunately, many of those with that provincial government were Jews, were Yidden. They surrendered. No foreign soldier had set foot on German soil. Germany had won the war on the Russian front. Germany was suffering a terrible setback on the Western Front, and they surrendered when they were still holding parts of France, certainly parts of Belgium. And that brought about tremendous anti-Semitism in Germany that led ultimately to the Holocaust. The Treaty of Versailles, which was signed after the war, if you ever have the time to study it, was is a story unto itself. It was a peace treaty between the powers in Germany, and Germany was not invited to negotiate the treaty. It was a very one-sided treaty, and it assured the fact that there would be war again. So this is the story of World War I, which began on Tisha B'Av, the death of Yidden. 1919, there was a follow-up war. Once the Russian communists consolidated power, they attacked Poland. And when they attacked Poland, another 150,000 Jews died in 1919-1920, in addition to 250,000 that died, because it was basically on both sides, a war that involved tremendous sinner to that old lie of the Tsar, of Rasputin, that the Jews were traitors, and the Jews were the ones causing their army to lose. Why else would their army lose if it wasn't that the Jews were traitors? So this is, as I say, story number one of World War I, in and of itself, a tragedy. Europe never recovered. Europe never recovered. The empires of Europe don't exist. The powers of Europe are basically imaginary. Yidden in Europe basically are small communities, not strong communities. And the world, you know, what happened to Yidden is in a great way, it mirrors one the other. And this is the tragedy. It was a tragedy of the deaths of many, and a tragedy of the uprooting, really, of traditional Jewish life, of Yiddish life, of Frumkeit, during times of terrible exile. Just imagine people running for their lives. And again, not running for their lives from their enemies, running for lives from their own country, are uprooted, discombobulated, are not keeping track of Shabbosis and Yom Tovim. And this was the uprooting of what existed. Europe was the place that Yidden ran after the Churban. Some Yidden ran south to Egypt. Most Yidden ran north to the countries that constitute Europe. And over the centuries spread out over the many countries of Europe. So that the Churban Europe started on Tisha B'Av. World War II was seen as a continuation of World War I in many ways. And that's the first story. That story by itself is enough of a Tisha B'Av story to understand that Tisha B'Av is the beginning of something which shavas, which changes the way the world exists for Klal Yisrael. And this was a change until today. Until today exists. Yiddishkeit was predominantly in the United States for a short period of time after World War II. And today, Baruch Hashem has returned to Eretz Yisrael. These are all things that didn't exist. Our grandfathers, not our great-great-grandfathers, but my grandfather, who passed away during the Holocaust, would never dream of a world order that we have today. And that's a shavas, that's a change that took place with Tisha B'Av. But I said I wanted to tell you two stories. One is the typical story of World War I, as I've told you briefly. There's a second story. The second story has to do with the Yad Hashem on Klal Yisrael, and the Yad Hashem on Eretz Yisrael, and things that took place. It's only 100 years later that we look back, that we could picture how HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who creates the Refuah before the Makkah, was doing things to make it happen, that Klal Yisrael would return to Eretz Yisrael. I'd like to make just a couple of basic historic points, and not any chidushin that I'm saying. I just would like to bring them to the fore, to an appreciation of where we are today. What I told you was a 15-minute abridged version of the history of World War I, and there are many wonderful books that discuss it. If somebody has the patience and a library in his bathroom, there's a book, The Guns of August, by Barbara Tuchman. It's a book about August of 1914. And it makes for fascinating reading. When you read it, you don't understand how it could have happened. Like I say, it reads like a novel. It was written it was published in 1962. It was written relatively in a short period after World War I. Some of the principals were still alive. And it talks about how it took place. It's not written from a Yiddish perspective at all. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu pulling the strings is the second story that I'd like to share with you. What I've told you is a war between Germany and Austria on one side, and Russia, France, and England on the other. What happened to the Turks? Had the Turks, who had no business in this war, stayed out of it, Eretz Yisrael would still be under Turkish rule. The Turks were not favorably inclined towards the Yidden. The Turkish control of Eretz Yisrael was one that involved basically Yidden. At that time, Eretz Yisrael had roughly 600,000 people and approximately 10% or 60,000 Jews. The Turks were not favorably inclined to the Jews. They were not looking for Jews to move into, to Palestine, as it was called. How did the Turks get into the war? The Turks were the sick man of Europe. They were the empire that was crumbling. It was an empire full of graft, of bribery. The army was not much of an army. And the Turks, in the previous 50 years, had lost pieces of land. Turkey, northern Turkey, you have Eretz Yisrael, above it Syria and Lebanon, above that Turkey. And then Turkey bridges into Europe under the Balkan countries, under the western boundaries of Russia. And when Russia attacked the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Turks were sure the Russians would win, and the Turks saw it as an opportunity to grab land for itself. And the Turks from the south attacked some of the lower countries, the Balkan countries, to try to seize some land for itself. It had no business being there. It was not a major force. The Russians had to rescue them. Rather, the Germans had to rescue them during the war. Because they felt that with Russia and Austria fighting, they could grab, and they weren't so capable of it. But that's how they got into the war. Now, as far as Klal Yisrael is concerned, the major player in the establishment of the State of Israel was Woodrow Wilson. Now, you'll tell me that it was Truman that recognized the State of Israel, and that's true. But in the history of World War I, Woodrow Wilson played a major part, Kiyat Hashem Olav, it's something you have to write a book to make this up. The world had existed with empires for centuries. Like I say, since Nebuchadnezzar, for almost 3,000 years, the world was empires, or countries that controlled countries. Woodrow Wilson rescued Russia. You're talking about trench warfare from the end of August of 1914. From the end of August, if you read The Guns of August, which is not a story of the whole World War I, just of August 1914, of July and August, it ends with a quote. It's a quote by one of the generals ordering their soldiers to stand their ground no matter what and better die than retreat, which is basically what happened as different countries during this trench warfare period tried to attack each other. A lot of death and a lot of just nothing happening. For 4 years, you have to picture being at war for 4 years and nothing happening, just bodies being shipped home from one side to the other. That's when they started to use artillery in warfare. In the 1800s, warfare was with the sword. And artillery to be able to shoot over trenches and kill people on the other side without having any tactical battle advantage, that's what took place. One of the jokes of World War I, if you can have a joke, was Big Bertha. Big Bertha was a cannon, an artillery gun owned by Germany that could shoot 25 or 30 miles. It was unheard of till its time. Of course, Big Bertha was named after the wife of the fellow who produced it, which apparently she was. And when you read about how they had this great cannon, but they had no way of transporting it. So it's comical about how they went around. It's like children trying to play some type of game of cops and robbers. But that, putting that aside, where did Wilson come in? How did that affect the cause, the establishment of a state of Israel? Now, Wilson, the United States rescued Europe from war. And Woodrow Wilson was a brilliant man. He was a personal, was an academic. He wasn't a politician. He wasn't I believe he was the head of Princeton University before becoming governor of New Jersey and then president. And he had grandiose ideas. And when he came into the war, he put out a 14-point plan for post-war Europe. The war was still going on. But he had the kayak because they were going nowhere. They were just fighting it. There was no end in sight. And his plan, which he imposed on his allies, included one of the points was that there would be no more empires. It sounds like such a noble idea. There'd be no more empires. Countries wouldn't control countries. Every country would have its own ability to determine its own government. And this was his idea. Now, of course, the United States didn't have an empire. We're just a big country. The Germans and the Russians and the French and the English had empires. But his, what he pushed was that there would be no empires, there'd be a League of Nations that would create countries. That's when Czechoslovakia, which was never a country, was created. Yugoslavia, which as soon as it fell out of communist rule, broke up into warring factions. And Poland. Poland had been a country centuries earlier. It was created. This was all created by the League of Nations, by Woodrow Wilson's idea of creating a world in which every country had self-determination. Now, that took place in 1917. Also in 1917, the Balfour Declaration was written. A declaration which in and of itself would have meant little, except that the Yidden of the world gave it a lot of meaning. When Klal Yisrael saw in the declaration, Lord Balfour was what we would call today the Secretary of State, the Foreign Minister of the English government, and he said that Her Majesty's government sees with favor the establishment of a Jewish state, so long as it doesn't infringe on any of the Arabs that are there. So basically, so long as it doesn't infringe was ignored by Klal Yisrael. And what was spread was this idea about Balfour. It was a very nice declaration, especially because England didn't control Palestine. The Turks did. And this was Balfour's declaration, which from a Yidden, Gedolei Yisrael saw as a turning point. Rav Palm would often say that the Chafetz Chaim, when he read about the Balfour declaration, put on Big Day Shabbos, and said, I only hope that it's not grabbed away by the secularists. I hope that the opportunity is not taken away. And the Balfour Declaration was incorporated into the mandate, ultimately, that Britain got. What happened when the war ended is that Europe was bound by Wilson's plan. And all the countries were owned by the Turks were now broken up into small countries, into all of the various countries. But the countries couldn't just control themselves. They didn't have government. That's why you have the word mandate. What does mandate mean? France and Britain took mandates to set up governments in each of these countries. And that's from where, ultimately, Klal Yisrael was able to return to Eretz Yisrael. Now, the point of the second half of the story is just as we understand that the Golus, Girish Spain, which was also a Tisha B'Av event, took place on the same day that Columbus set out to discover the United States. The Seas of Refuah were taking place at the time of the tragedy. So too, when World War I began, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was planting seeds of Klal Yisrael coming back to Eretz Yisrael, as we're fortunate enough to be there today. So this is a Tisha B'Av story. My point in the whole story is an appreciation of the theme of Shavas. The idea of Tisha B'Av being a time that the world changes, and changes take place in the world. Thematic changes, fundamental changes, changes that affect everybody. It's a different world. We, who are fortunate enough to live in the Schussim, of those who went through the Holocaust don't understand. We think pogroms is something from the Middle Ages. Now, we fail to understand that in 1919, 1920, there were pogroms all over Poland. Poland, which eventually became a place that was quite hospitable to Jews between the wars, at that time was a place of terrible pogroms. And we're not talking about so long ago. We're talking about a time period, and not where enemies in battle do battle, but where a person's own country sets out to start up with Klal Yisrael. That nekuda, that idea, which Baruch Hashem were far from, God forbid, ever experiencing, is something that has to be understood, has to be appreciated when Tisha B'Av comes. This appreciation, we set out to look at one big story. From the Surah, which is the beginning of Kinnis, till today, a story of a changing world for Klal Yisrael, a story of a greater and greater distancing from an appreciation of Ruchnius, a story of a world in which we're more and more involved in a lot of Gashmius, a lot of the day-to-day life, and less in Ruchnius. It's a world in which we miss the Beis HaMikdash more than ever. And today, proud as we are that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has brought us back to Eretz Yisrael, we feel the terrible tsar of a government, of a majority of Jews, that don't appreciate our Messiah, Teresenu HaKadosh, and we feel that if we can mourn the passing of a time where Yad Hashem HaTov Aleinu was more open, where Yad Hashem HaTov Aleinu was something we could appreciate, where we could see Ruchnius, we could come to a place and see a Rebbe could take a class on a trip to the Beis HaMikdash and watch the Kayin take the Trumas HaDeshen and drop it on the side of the Mizbeach, and every day, even in the second Beis HaMikdash, the earth opened up and swallowed the ashes. That would be a trip. That would be a summer trip where boys would go, instead of boys saying, where do you want to go for the summer? To theme parks, to adventure parks, to ball games. Even to go to Mekemes HaKadoshim, to places where they'd be imbued with Ruchnius. This is what we're mourning. And we look at the time period from the Churban until today as one long time period of HaKadosh Baruch Hu guiding Klal Yisrael through the different Golos. If you look at the first four Kinnis, I mention every year, the first four Kinnis are a snapshot of Kinnis. Unfortunately, and if I was being Mesader Kinnis, of course I probably could do it better, but saying that tongue-in-cheek, the first Kinnis are hard to understand. I would have started with the Kinnis which follow, which are easier to understand. The first Kinnah talks about the disdain with which the Goyim hold Klal Yisrael, which started with the Churban and exists throughout this entire period of time. The first lines could easily be said about the Jews' experience in Russia during the war, in Poland after the war. The Kadosh Baruch Hu, Yishmereinu, should give a shmirah from him. Shavas, the world came to a stop, it changed. Suru meni shimuni oivrei. Though the goyim around us said, Suru meni, turn away from me. Schiyu mois hesimuni beedre chaveirei. Klal Yisrael has been labeled schiyu mois, filth and disgusting. Sakoisa mishkam miskois debirai. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you have sakoisa, lashon of sukkah, you have covered the mishkan, miskois debirai. That it was not able to protect my the yidden, the my soldiers that were in the Beis HaMikdash. Sakoisi have covered them, and my strong ones were killed. Safku kaf umadu evarai. This constant lashon of safku kaf is this experience of yidden, which we are fortunate to live in a generation where it's not that way, in a community, in a country where it's not that way. But the idea of schiu mois esimuni, of Safku Kaf, the Safku Kaf, the riding, clapping of hands against the Yidden, is the experience that we mourn. It's a change from the time of Shlomo HaMelech, of a Beis HaMikdash, a time where the Beis HaMikdash was the place of the world, to a time where Klal Yisrael, unfortunately, is not looked at that way. I had the ill fortune, I was good fortune, I was going for a wedding to be in Switzerland. I don't know why anybody would give any money to people in Switzerland, but Switzerland is a country, it still has the German anti-Semitism. Unless you go to the Alps, where you pay them a lot of money, and they're willing to swallow it for a few minutes. And I remember I was there for a wedding. I remember going into a drugstore to buy a toothbrush. And feeling the sinna of the goyim that are there. It still exists. The siyu loy samuni bedre chaveirai still exists. And together with that recognition of what the korban has brought, we express our gratitude to Rabbi Nishal Olam that we're in a medina shel chesed, in a time of chesed where we don't suffer it. But it's there. It's there under the surface. And if it's not for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Yad, it would still be there. The first kapitel talks about the Tsar of the Chorban. The next one, in the Yaskol Kinnis label Zion, is a Taina Kaviyachot to the Rabbi Nishalom. Echa Atzda Pecha, how could this be? The third Kinnah Ches, is beautifully expressed. Not that it needs my Haskama, but even simple people like us can understand it. The Mekainet says, I wish I could go up to Shemayim. Adat kuk shamayim ele iti shamayim or yoy machvira para. I wish I could go up to heaven, kaviyachla mitaveh, the Rabbeinu Shalom. What's going on? How could it happen, such a change in the world order, that Klal Yisrael, from being a Klal Yisrael with the Beis HaMikdash, the center of the world, to be the steel voice to the nations of the world. The language is beautiful. And it's followed by Kapitel Tes, which is sort of a tzidduk hadin by Klal Yisrael. It talks about the Teichacha. Kin Tes, each paragraph ends with a piece, first of the beginning of Parashas Bruchu Kaisai, the promises of In Tishmu, and B'chaisei Teileichu, and then with the Imlai Sishmo and the Teichacha. So it's a set. It talks about what happened. The next two kinnas talk about the Tviya, Kaviyach, to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. And the fourth kinnah, Kinnah Tes, talks about the Kabbalah Hadin by Klal Yisrael. As we set out to say kinnas, I'd like to remind those of anybody who will be leaving before we get to the end of kinnas, to remember we didn't finish davening, we still have to say Asher Yevolitzin and Aleinu. Someone, for whatever reason, has to leave earlier. Please don't neglect to say Asher Yevolitzin. I'd also point out, it's better to say the kinnis slowly, to say fewer kinnis, or even fewer, a smaller part of kinnis, and to say it understanding the meaning. It's Siman Aleph in Shulchan Aruch, that it's Yafa, these type of things, it's Yafa Ma'at the Kavana, the Harvey Shalai the Kavana.